This is study number 27 in our Western American camp meeting in the year 1999. So we are studying the education according to the Divine Family Plan, education that brings forth children who can crush the serpent's head. And I want to read a piece of the book Education here, which is a very good book. And each time we read it again, it becomes more precious. We turn to page 290. Rules should be few and well considered. Rules should be few and well considered. That's another problem, of course, that with some children, they constantly get told, do this, do this, do this, do this, and so forth. I think there's a mistrust behind it. Parents can't trust the children, or they don't trust the children to do the right things, or they are constantly ruled. They should be few, give them a little bit more trust, and if they make mistakes, then take them aside later and teach them wherein this mistake was, patiently and kindly. But in the effort to prevent these mistakes, sometimes very many rules are given. Rules should be few and well considered. Well considered. And when once made, they should be enforced. That is an important rule. When once made, they should be enforced. Very often it is so that one parent makes a rule and the other parent thinks that is too strict. And so it tries to change it somehow, that rule. But this is the worst damage you can do, because in this way the authority of the parent is undermined. Now, if something is against the word of God, let's say so, which usually is not the case in a Christian home, but if it should be, then let the parents talk with each other first and clarify this issue and then present a united front to the child, but not give a different picture to the child. The father says this, this, the mother says that. That is really very bad. They should be, once made, they should be enforced. Whatever it is found impossible to change, the mind learns to recognize and adapt itself to, but the possibility of indulgence induces desire, hope, and uncertainty. And the results are restless, irritably, and insubordination. That's what it says here. Okay. And insubordination. Okay. But the possibility of indulgence induces desire, hope, and uncertainty. Desire, hope. Let's not worry about the word now. It's not so important. So, but the possibility of indulgence induces desire, hope, and uncertainty. And the results are restlessness, irritability, and insubordination. It should be made plain that the government of God knows no compromise with evil. Neither in the home nor in the school should disobedience be tolerated. No parent or teacher who has at heart the well-being of those under his care will compromise with a stubborn self-will that defies authority or resorts to subterfuge or evasion in order to escape obedience. That is something. It is not love, but sentimentalism that palters with wrongdoing, seeks by coaxing and bribes to secure compliance, and finally accepts some substitute in place of the thing required. What is it? Sentimentalism. What is sentimentalism? Rule of feelings. What has this to do with feelings? Very much, because the same way that you treat your feelings, you teach your children. If you don't educate your children right, if you don't really command them after you, as Abraham did, then you don't command your feelings. It's the same thing. And how often do parents indulge in appetites and passions, sinful passions? How can they properly educate their children? How can they? I mean, they have a bad conscience. They do not have power anymore to do this. Now, what I find very interesting is the role of the mind that Sister White describes here. Whatever it is found impossible to change, the mind learns to recognize and adapt itself to. So children, they learn to recognize and adapt themselves to even unpleasant things. But indulgence induces desire, sinful desire, of course, hope that I get through with my self-will, and uncertainty. They don't know, really. And the results are restlessness, irritably, and insubordination. So, fools make a mock at sin, Proverbs 14, verse 9. We should beware of treating sin as a light thing. Terrible is its power over the wrongdoer. His own iniquities shall take the wicked himself, and he shall be holden to the courts of his sins. The greatest wrong done to a child or youth is to allow him to become fastened in the bondage of evil habit. The youth have an inborn love of liberty. They desire freedom, and they need to understand that these inestimable blessings are to be enjoyed only in obedience to the law of God. The law is the preserver of true freedom and liberty. It points out and prohibits those things that degrade and enslave, and thus to the obedient it affords protection from the power of evil. The psalmist says, I will walk at liberty, for I seek thy precepts. Thy testimonies are also my delight and my counselors. This is Psalm 119, verse 45 and 24. And now we turn back again to patriarchs and prophets and want to read a little bit more about Abram's education. Let parental authority be taught and enforced as the first step in obedience to authority of God. What is the first thing to be learned, understanding or obedience? What does this practically mean? Before a child can understand, it must obey. And that is something which many don't agree. They think when the child does not understand, it cannot be expected to obey. How often do children say, to parents say, oh, this child is too little yet. You can't expect this. And often parents say this without really understanding what they say. It happened to me not too long ago. A child was coming to my office, drawing everything open and so forth. And I said, no, the child didn't obey. Then the parent came in and I didn't know what to do. I still said no. And then the parent said, oh, the child is too small. It can't understand. I thought, that is not right. It's not too small to obey. It needs to obey before it understands. You see, that's often an excuse. The child is too small. It cannot understand. Think how often have we allowed this excuse to hinder obedience. That should not be. There should be first obedience. That's the very first lesson. You may say, but this is blind obedience. We want to understand too what we follow, don't we? We didn't follow just the Sabbath West Advent Church like this. We wanted to understand it first. And before we were baptized, didn't we want to understand it first? We weren't baptized blindly. It is true that understanding is an important point. It is an important point. But even with understanding, there will be always things which we do not understand. In the kingdom of God, there will be always mysteries which we cannot comprehend. And we need to follow him in trust. That's what he expects from us. And this is something children need to learn first, to trust, even if they do not understand. And they can do this if they have been trained from the beginning to true obedience, instead of first waiting until they understand. Oh, let's wait until the child understands, and then we can cooperate with it. Then we can enlist its will and so forth. No, you must obey first. Now, you can enlist the will of the child even when it does not understand. By simply making it understand, it can trust you. You follow the rule of God, so the child can trust you. And that is the basis, really, trust in a family. So, they need to be taught, let parental authority be taught and enforced as the first step in obedience to the authority of God. The light esteem in which the law of God is held, even by religious leaders, has been productive of great evil. The teaching, which has become so widespread that the divine statutes are no longer binding upon men, is the same as idolatry in its effect upon the morals of the people. Those who seek to lessen the claims of God's holy law are striking directly at the foundation of the government of families and nations. Religious parents, failing to walk in his statutes, do not command their household to keep the way of the Lord. The law of God is not made the rule of life. The children, as they make homes of their own, feel under no obligation to teach their children what they themselves have never been taught. And this is why there are so many godless families. This is why depravity is so deep and widespread. Not until parents themselves walk in the way of the Lord, with perfect hearts will they be prepared to command their children after him. A reformation in this respect is needed, a reformation which shall be deep and broad. In the first meeting today, we talked about the fact that we need to be reformed before we can reform the world. We need to be educated before we can educate the world, and before we can be successful in building up institutions that educate the world. A reformation in this respect is needed, a reformation which shall be deep and broad. Parents need to reform. Ministers need to reform. They need God in their households. If they would see a different state of things, they must bring his word into their families and must make it their counselor. They must teach their children that it is the voice of God addressed to them, and it is to be implicitly obeyed. So they are the primary messengers, so to speak, for the children, and they need to teach this to them. They should patiently instruct their children kindly and untiringly, teach them how to live in order to please God, kindly and untiringly. I really must stress the fact that if the spirit of obedience is not implanted, you can try and kindly and untiringly, but it will not bring real success. The spirit of obedience really must implant it first, and then kindly and untiringly teaching is necessary still. How to live in order to please God. The children of such a household are prepared to meet the sophistries of infidelity. They have accepted the Bible as the basis of their faith, and they have a foundation that cannot be swept away by the incoming tide of skepticism. In too many households, prayer is neglected. Parents feel that they have no time for morning and evening worship. They cannot spare a few moments to be spent in thanksgiving to God for his abundant mercies, for the blessings, and so forth. The importance of prayer is now emphasized. I cannot read everything. Time is really running out. In the next paragraphs, I really recommend that you read this. And then it says in the last paragraphs, from every Christian home, a holy light should shine forth. Love should be revealed in action. It should flow out in all home intercourse, showing itself in thoughtful kindness, in gentle, unselfish courtesy. There are homes where this principle is carried out, homes where God is worshipped, and truest love reigns. From these homes, morning and evening prayer ascend to God as sweet incense, and his merits and blessings descend, mercies and blessings descend upon the suppliants like the morning dew. That is a blessing, and that is the seeds who crushed the serpent's head. 144,000. Can you see this? It's a fulfillment of Genesis 3, verse 15. A well-ordered Christian household is a powerful argument in favor of the reality of the Christian religion, an argument that the infidel cannot gainsay. All can see that there is an influence at work in the family that affects the children, and that the God of Abraham is with them. If the homes of professed Christians had a right religious mold, they would exert a mighty influence for good. They would indeed be the light of the world. What does this mean? They would indeed be the light of the world. Arise, shine, for thy light comes, and the glory of the Lord is risen above thee. That is the fulfillment of this. The God of heaven speaks to every faithful parent in the words addressed to Abraham, I know him, that he will command his children and his household after him, And they shall keep the way of the Lord to do justice and judgment, that the Lord may bring upon Abram that which he hath spoken of him. What has he spoken to you and me? That the seed will crush the serpent's head. And to this we are looking forward, really. Especially now with this message, that is a real privilege. However, there's quite a lot of work to do to understand our own feelings and understand where we have not properly ruled them. And this will give us, make us much wiser parents. Much, much wiser parents. As we submit our will to the will of God and our feelings to our reason, so will we submit our children to our guidance, which is under God. I want to, in this context, point to one factor, and that is, or to one question, that is toys. I don't know in what connection I studied this in the past, but I'm just remembering it here. Now, in this education, what role do toys play? What kind of toys should children have? Yeah. What kind of toys do children normally have today? Maybe when you go to a toy shop, when you go in the mall at the toy shop, what do we have there? A real dream world. You stand before a toy shop, you stand before a dream world. Isn't this so? In every respect. And I think the nearer you come to the end, the more it is. You know, there's so much technology in it which places you in a dream world. That's just amazing. And, for example, gunships and tanks and soldiers and, I don't know, when I was a child, we had little soldiers and Indians and cowboys and so forth to play with. Today they have, I think, monsters and so forth. And this are the kind of toys that children like. What do children tend to play very quickly with? With sticks and then shoot each other. Very quickly. I'm quite amazed. Or they fight with each other. Very quickly. Children, right? That is a temptation. A real temptation. And we must resist this. Because that is a dream world. And parents must fight against this from the earliest moments. And I myself, when I was a child, I liked to play with little guns. I mean, I didn't have a real gun, but with sticks, which I used as guns. And then we shot each other like this. I love at this, but it's not to love, really, because it's a dream world, and a bad one, too. And we really need to see that that this is the human nature. This is the tendency. And the industry has discovered this, of course, and they foster it by putting children in that dream world. Also teddy bears and dolls and so forth. It's all for a dream world. And it, isn't it? And it places people in a dream world. Now, we really need to understand that such things develop the mind in a certain direction. And what is the end of it? Sensuality. That is the end of it. When you look at the dolls today in shops, I mean, you just need to look. You don't need to look at them. You know exactly where the thoughts are going. Fancy, vanity, fashion, sensuality, and so forth. This is the direction which these things are going. So can we give our children such toys? And even cars today. I mean, hundreds and thousands of cars are on the road all the time, racing cars, and this car, and that car, and so forth. And so that already, when I was a child, and I once got a car, I really loved to play with this. I looked at it, brum, 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 and in my mind, I was sitting in that car, and, you know, I was so happy that I didn't have a brother, so that I didn't need to share. I still remember this, and it's interesting that such selfish thoughts would come up in that connection. That is not unusual. So can we really give such our children the best? What children, what toys would Jesus have? What do you think? Yeah, when he was a child, I think he wouldn't have a saw when he was a little child. What would he have? He would have the earth of the ground to play with. He would have, of course, the flowers, the grass. He would have, and sticks of the forest, the trees. These were his toys. And blessed are those children whose parents don't have enough money to buy toys, because that's their toys. And don't think that they are dwarfed because they don't have different toys. You can develop a lot of fantasy with these things, good fantasy. It needs still to be directed. Otherwise, even sticks can become cannons, so to speak. You have to really still direct it. But why is this so superior, that kind of toy? Because it connects. It's easier to connect the mind with God. Can you connect the mind with God when children pray with a car or with a tank even or with a warplane or something like this? Can you connect? Now, I do not want to condemn now every little toy, so to speak. For example, this planes there. I think there are some harmless things which need not be. I like to make this for children too. Paper airplanes, not in the worship room though. There, I take it away from children. But that is natural somehow, and some things also foster the vision or the ability to work. So it could be that maybe even some of the more modern toys can have a certain sense. Or a certain aim in order to teach them a certain skill. It's like a saw or a hammer, as you said, a toy saw and a toy hammer, or a toy stove in which I can cook my first soup or make my first popcorn or whatever. Zweibeck, that's right. So these are things that are really the sensible things. But just things that are for the fantasy and have no other aim but fantasy, that is something that really needs to be cut off. We need to understand this. So, that was only a side remark. I think I wanted to study this in connection with the circumstances, which play a great role. Remember how we studied that circumstances often have a weightier influence than the example of parents. And one of the circumstances with which children grow up is toys. And didn't you find, I mean, I found it always, when children have a lot of toys, they can't appreciate them. They usually tear out the legs of the dolls, of the teddy bears, the eye is scraped out of the teddy bear, or the nose cut off, or the ear cut off. If they would sew them together again, then they would be doctors, but no. They are really torn off. I've observed this so often. And the more they have, the more wild play there is with these things. And with cars, zoom, they are not just flying, they're flying over the room on the other side. And very soon the cars miss wheels and so forth. But no problem, they get a new one. Next birthday is coming, so they get 10 new ones at the birthday. So why should they take care so much of this car? It's understandable, isn't it? It's really a cruelty, a very cruelty done to children. We need to understand this. Parents think they do well, but it's cruelty done to them. So circumstances form our children very much, and toys are circumstances. I can I must say that my parents were poor, and so I did not have much children and much toys when I was a child. I can remember staying in the garden when my mother was gardening. And I stayed with her there. I myself was not exactly gardening. Maybe she should have taught me a little bit, even when I was small, but for some reason she didn't. So what I did, I made my own thoughts there. And I imagined heaven in the garden. So I would begin to draw lines and say, well, this is the heaven I see. Now, beyond this, there's another heaven. And there's another heaven. And then I would draw one heaven after the other and would enter from one heaven into the other. I can remember that game which I played. And so children really make fantasy, so to speak. And the earth is a very good tool. You can do a lot with it. Even if you get dirty, it's fantastic. And fosters intelligence. So let us leave it with this. I want to dwell now a little bit on the results of Abraham's education, which is quite important. Isaac was such a result, and he's really a fantastic example of the spirit of obedience. We turn now to the 13th chapter in Patriarchs and Prophets. It's entitled The Test of Faith. Now, we begin on page 146. The birth of Isaac, bringing, after a lifelong waiting, the fulfillment of their dearest hopes, filled the tents of Abraham and Sarah with gladness. But to Hagar, this event was the overthrow of her fondly cherished ambitions. Ishmael, now a youth, had been regarded by all, and so forth. No, we don't want to read all this. Finally, he had to be cast out. And then we read on page 147, God had called Abraham to be the father of the faithful, and his life was to stand as an example of faith to succeeding generations. But his faith had not been perfect. He had shown distrust of God in concealing to succeeding generations. By concealing the fact, thank you, that Sarah was his wife, and again in his marriage with Hagar. That he might reach the highest standard, God subjected him to another test, the closest which man was ever called to endure. In a vision of the night, he was directed to repair to the land of Moriah, and there offer up his son as a burnt offering upon a mountain that should be shown him. Now, when you remember that Isaac was the only left child after he had to cast out Ishmael, and that he was the child of his old age, a miracle child, the only child, and that he was required to offer him, not just that he would lose him, but he was required to offer him, you begin to guess what a test this was for Abraham. It must have been tremendous. You can compare Abraham's test with it to some degree, where Abraham had to depart from his wife. And Adam did not pass the test. But Abraham, he passed the test. And why? Because he had a mature Christian experience, which meant freedom from sentimentalism. He was so free of sentimentalism that he was ready even for that crowning sacrifice in his old age. That is amazing. That is really a wonderful, shining example of how free we can be from the power of sentimentalism. Can you imagine what feelings Abram had when he got this command? Can you imagine this? What would his feelings tell him? You cannot do that. You cannot do that. But what would reason tell him? You must do it because God says so. There was a struggle of feelings wanting to rule in this moment, you can be sure. But they did not rule. His reason remained the upper hand, even though it was a hard struggle for him. 3 days he had to struggle. And he walked towards the Mount Moriah. He did not even dare to tell his wife. Why not? Because he feared that her feelings could not be governed by reason. Had he reason to do this, to fear this? Probably he knew his wife, but it is women who are the weaker part. And as I said before, for them to rule over the feelings is more difficult than for men. Therefore, when they get the victory, it's the greater victory, isn't it? But in the case of Abraham, he thought to spare Sarah this torture. That was not only because he feared that she would, but also he wanted to spare her this torture. So Abram went forward in obedience day after day, always hoping that God may revert this terrible command to offer his son Isaac. So he was walking towards the mountain, and Abraham and Isaac was going with him. Now, what is amazing is not only the freedom from sentimentalism that Abram had, but also that Isaac had in this moment. Let's turn now to page 151. There it says, side by side, the father and the son journeyed in silence. The patriarch, pondering his heavy secret, had no heart for words. His thoughts were of the proud, fond mother, and the day when he should return to her alone. Well he knew that the knife would pierce her heart when it took the life of her son. That day, the longest that Abram had ever experienced, dragged slowly to its close. While his son and the young men were sleeping, he spent the night in prayer, still hoping that some heavenly messenger might come to say that the trial was enough, and so forth. And then he saw the desired sign, this cloud. And it says, even now he did not murmur against God, but strengthened his soul by dwelling upon the evidence of the Lord's goodness and faithfulness. That is how he maintained the control of reason over feelings. How? By dwelling upon the goodness of God. So when feelings want to come back, what do we need to do? We need to dwell on the promises of God. If we neglect this, then we have lost. You know, we are on a slope. We constantly need that string to hold ourselves and pull ourselves up. We can't afford to stop praying and strengthening ourselves on the promises. It says, this son had been unexpectedly given and had not he who bestowed the precious gift a right to recall his own. Then faith repeated the promise, in Isaac shall thy seed be called, a seed numberless as the grains of the sand upon the shore. Isaac was a child of a miracle, and could not the power that gave him life restore it? You see, that is exactly that what Adam could have done too. Exactly the same thoughts that Adam should have, Abram had. It's really a redemption of the failure of Adam, you can say. Then faith repeated the promise, in Isaac shall thy seed be called, a seed numberless as the grains of the sand upon the shore. Isaac was a child of miracle, and could not the power that gave him life restore it. Sorry, we have read this already. Now when it goes on, we see that finally the father had to tell his son, at the appointed place they built an altar, laid the woods upon it. Then with trembling voice, Abram unfolded to his son the divine message. It was with terror and amazement that Isaac learned his fate, but he offered no resistance. That is obedience to the top. It was not a legal obedience. It was not that he had to do this. Not at all. Not that he expected any reward for it or did it for self-righteousness, but it was out of love, out of appreciation for the Savior who had died for him, that he was willing to give his life. It was by faith that Isaac really gave this obedience that really needs to be understood. Let's read this here in the next. It says, he could have escaped his doom had he chosen to do so. The grief-stricken old man, exhausted with the struggle of those terrible days, could not have opposed the will of the vigorous youth. But Isaac had been trained from his childhood to ready, trusting obedience. And as the purpose of God was opened before him, he yielded a willing submission. Not just submission, a willing submission. There's a difference between submission and willing submission. What is the difference? It's a difference between legal obedience and true obedience. Legal obedience is submission, but true obedience is willing submission. And how do you see if a submission is willing? When it is given with a glad heart, with a true conviction that speaks for itself. So this was the personality of Isaac. How old was he there? Yeah, at that, I forgot it now. But he was a young lad. That's what we read here. We could study this a little bit, but he was not very old. So what kind of personality had he? A very strong personality already. He was very mature. About 20? Was he exactly 100? Okay. So if he was 20, then which could be right according to the statement, a young lad. So then even with 20, he was already quite a mature person. Who would be give such an obedience, such a willing obedience, trusting obedience, as the purpose of God was opened before him, he yielded a willing submission. He was a sharer in Abraham's faith, and he felt that he was honored in being called to give his life as an offering to God. He tenderly seeks to lighten the father's grief, and encourages his nerveless hands to bind the cords that confine him to the altar. It's interesting. Even though it was his death, he was strengthening his father. He was encouraging him. You see, his father's... He was old, you know, and the older we become, you can say the weaker we become. So he was rather weak. And it was a terrible struggle for him these last 3 days. So that the rest of his powers, his reason ruled over his feelings. And now his son helps him in that. His son, in the strength of his youth, really let his reason fully rule over his feelings. What would his feelings have told him? Run away. Run as fast as you can. But reason told him, my father does what God told him. I trust him fully. This willing obedience was installed in him from childhood on. Obey before you understand. He did not understand why God commanded this. Neither could his father tell him why. He could give no reason. He could have asked him, why? Tell me why. Father could have given no reason. So he simply trusted and obeyed. That is a mature Christian experience. We really need to see this. Do you see that we need such an experience to go through Jacob's trouble? Children and youth, is this our experience? That can be our experience, like Jacob. That can be our experience. We have to really strive for that maturity of character to support our trembling parents when they do their duty. We have to support them. Even if it's binding us, so to speak, on the altar. Of course, God will not require them to take our lives. He didn't even Abraham require this, because an angel said, wait, don't kill him. So the situation is this, that Isaac is a true product of that education of God, of Abraham's. We really need to understand that this is the kind of person that is crushing the serpent's head, and the kind of children that we need to produce in order to crush the serpent's head. And again, let us see how we treat our own feelings, that is, how we treat our children. We must get victory over sentimentalism. Do you see this? We must get it. Otherwise, there will never be a generation that crushes the serpent's head. We have a work to do. When I look at it, it seems a huge work, but I must look on the promises of God, must rely on them. We all must, in order to fulfill that great commission. Now, unfortunately, we can't study this now. Isaac, when he got old, he did not have the same stamina, it seems, as his father had. He had some favoritism, as you know. He had two sons, Esau and Jacob, and he showed favoritism to one. Maybe in brief, we want to look at it tomorrow. We have considered already the marriage of Isaac briefly, and there we see also filial obedience. And then tomorrow we will also look at the life of Jesus as a life of absolute victory over sentimentalism.